Chapter 36. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia, USA. Irene Kennedy pushed her reading glasses onto her forehead, trying to chase the image of Stan Hurley from her mind. There would be time to mourn him later. Right now, her only responsibility was to ensure that no more of her people ended up like him. The handwritten list on the desk in front of her had been pulled almost entirely from her impeccable memory. It looked as innocuous as a guest list to one of her son's birthday parties, but in fact, it was the most sensitive catalog of names ever put to paper. It included every significant spy or informant currently controlled by the CIA, from the Middle East to China to Europe. Even South America and Australia were represented. Three numbers accompanied each name. The first ranked the likelihood that Rickman would be aware of that individual's existence on a scale of 1 to 10. The second used an inverse scale to rank each operative's importance to America's security. Finally, the third number was the sum of the first two. The 20s, people who were low-level and unquestionably known by Rickman, were already being prepared for extraction. Too much risk for not enough reward. The 2s, critical personnel that Rickman would likely be unaware of, would be staying where they were. The question was, how far down did she go with extractions? 15s? 10s? How many lives would she jeopardize in the interest of America's intelligence efforts? Once again, Hurley intruded on her thoughts, this time whispering in her ear, "You took this job, Princess. Suck it up and do it." There was a knock on the door, and Mike Nash poked his head in. "Bad time?" She flipped the list face down on her desk. "A welcome interruption. Are you bringing me good news?" He entered but didn't respond to her question. "I'll take anything at this point, Mike." "Coffee machine's fixed." Kennedy smiled. She still wasn't sure about Nash, but her view of the man was evolving. She'd been doing some detailed research into his background and discovered that he'd always been the charismatic charmer. Voted most popular in high school, class president in college, and the beneficiary of almost fanatical loyalty from the Marines he'd led in combat. It was a gift that few people had, and one that couldn't be taught. Kennedy had many competent people working for her, but their personalities often left a bit to be desired, mostly insufferable wonks, slick politicians, and swaggering cowboys. Then there was Mitch, who wasn't exactly a favorite on Capitol Hill. At best, he elicited nervousness from Congress. At worst, fear and hatred. Kennedy didn't exempt herself from her clear-eyed evaluation. She was largely seen as an icy intellectual alone in a sea of people who made decisions based on their gut instead of their head. It was a trait that made people question whether there was anything she really believed in. The answer was that there was. She believed in getting the job done. Nash could be a bit of a hand-wringer, but admittedly an extremely intelligent one. He'd performed well since Rapp had forced him out of the field and behind a desk. He was good at handling the overblown egos on the Hill, and a near prodigy at motivating people. While she and Nash were very different, who was to say that her approach was right and his was wrong? As her mentor, Thomas Stansfield, had been fond of saying, there was more than one way to skin a cat. "Unfortunately, I'm a tea drinker," Kennedy said. "Where are we on finding the people disseminating the Rickman files?"
"Let's just say we're moving generally forward," he said, sitting in one of the chairs lined up in front of her desk.
"Everyone agrees with your idea that he'd go to an attorney, but the category, every ambulance chaser on the planet, is a pretty big one." "Is the NSA producing?"
"That's the problem. Their AI's ability to filter out the junk is less impressive than they let on. We're getting everything from a bunch of lawyers in D.C. who won an intramural softball game to a London firm that signed on to represent J.K. Rowling in a plagiarism suit."
"Nothing useful, then."
"We thought we had something with a break-in at a firm in Buenos Aires, but it turned out to be a drug addict who got caught 2 days later pawning their laptops. We have people working around the clock, sifting through all the hits. Anything that looks even vaguely interesting gets sent to me."
"What about Marcus?"
He's working on the next step under the assumption that the NSA will eventually turn up something we can use. He figures that the files are being released by some kind of hacker, someone crooked enough to be willing to decrypt and send out classified material, but smart enough to keep it from being traced back to him. Finding a guy like that should be right in Marcus's wheelhouse. Kennedy took a sip of her tea, not sure how much to say. It was in her nature to keep secrets, but if things went as badly as she expected, Nash would need to be aware of her suspicions. "We have even less time than you might imagine, Mike. I believe that we're not just in a race against Rick, but that we're competing with another organization." Nash nodded. "The Pakistanis." She was pleased that he'd come to the conclusion on his own. "Please, go on." "It's hard to believe that Akhtar Durrani was the only person in the S-Wing who knew about Rick's files. And if they're aware they exist, they want them something awful. Depending on how much Rick knew, the ISI could co-opt our entire network in the Middle East. Maybe worldwide." "But who?" Kennedy prompted. "One of Durrani's men? If you work for the ISI, getting hold of the CIA's throat wouldn't exactly be bad for your career." It was a reasonable hypothesis, maybe even the right one, but she was concerned Nash was thinking too small. "What about President Chutani?" Nash's expression turned thoughtful. "There's no question that Chutani would like to take a peek at Rick's files and hold some of them over us, but I'm not sure he has that kind of penetration into the S-Wing yet." "I tend to agree. Have you considered Ahmed Taj?" "Yeah, he's a lot more interesting." "How so?" Kennedy said, wondering if Nash recognized he was being tested and just wasn't letting on. She hoped that was the case. "I've met the guy a couple times, and I've read all the files we've got on him. Everything points to him being weak. I'm starting to wonder, though, Durrani's death would have created quite a power vacuum at the ISI. We should have seen a lot of fireworks, but we didn't. I've seen successions in my kids' Boy Scout troop go harder than that." Kennedy remained silent, taking another sip of her tea. "So do you think I'm totally off base here, Irene? Maybe Chutani's got a better handle on the ISI than I'm giving him credit for."
"No. Unfortunately, I find myself nursing the same suspicions. Our analysts have been telling me for years that Taj is too feeble to control the ISI, and in the same breath, they tell me that the ISI is becoming increasingly effective. Somewhere there's a disconnect between theory and reality. If you discard the conventional wisdom that Taj is just a figurehead, it's amazing how quickly the picture comes into focus."
"I hope you're wrong," Nash said, "because I'd rather see those files in the hands of Al-Qaeda than the ISI." Before she could respond, an alarm sounded on her laptop. She felt her heart rate accelerate. That particular chime was set to sound only when an email arrived from Joe Rickman. "Rick?" Nash said, noticing her sudden pallor. She nodded and opened her inbox as he moved to a position where he could look over her shoulder. The attachment was another video. Kennedy felt her mouth go dry when she started the playback.
"Hello, Irene. I'd say it's good to see you, but I can't see you because you had me killed."
He was sitting with his boots on the desk again, wearing the same clothes he had in the last communique. Knowing Rickman, he'd recorded these all in one caffeine and amphetamine-fueled push.
"I hope it drives you nuts trying to figure out how I got all this intel. Take my advice and don't bother. I'm just smarter than you."
He paused dramatically, letting the seconds tick by.
"Freaking out yet, Irene? Want to know what I've got? 'Cause this one's way bigger than Sitting Bull. I mean, who really gives a crap about the Russians? Nothing but a bunch of vodka-swilling losers."
"I can't tell you how much I wish I'd been there when Mitch splattered this prick's brains all over the wall," Nash said. Kennedy motioned for silence.
"Okay, I guess you've waited long enough," Rickman said. "I sent the Iranians a detailed file about how their ambassador to the UK is on your payroll. Names, dates, bank account numbers. Even a few nice, glossy 8x10s.
He smiled and reached for a remote on his desk.
"Have fun."
"Is that true?" Nash said when the image went black. Kennedy was too stunned to answer. It was absolutely true. Kamal Safavi was their highest-placed Iranian asset, a man well-versed in both his country's fledgling nuclear weapons program and its increasingly severe political power struggles.
What time is it in London, Mike?
He glanced at his watch. Around midnight. Kennedy shut down her email and pulled up Safavi's information. She clicked on the text button and sent him an innocuous message that he would recognize as a warning. The contingency plan they'd created was for him and his family to immediately proceed to a safe house where they'd be met by her London station chief. The question was whether Rickman had left time. Would he have seen it as more destructive to let the United States take the man and weather the inevitable Iranian demands for his return, or would he want the Ayatollah to take him and extract everything he knew about the CIA's Iranian operations?
"Where's Mitch?" Kennedy asked.
"We still don't know. He said he had some personal business to deal with and took one of the Gulf Streams we have hangared in Europe."
"During this?" Kennedy said, letting a rare flash of anger show. "You're supposed to keep track of him, Mike. And the agency's planes aren't his private limousines."
"Then that's a conversation you should have with him, Irene. Because sometimes he gets a look on his face like he's trying to decide whether it would be more efficient to argue with me or just kill me. As far as I'm concerned, he can do whatever he wants with those planes." Kennedy's line buzzed, and she picked up. Ken Barrett, her London station chief, was on the other end. He'd been copied on the text she'd sent. "I have people on their way to the safe house, Dr. Kennedy. Do you want me to send anyone to the ambassador's residence?" She didn't answer immediately. Maybe Rickman had timed this to provoke a confrontation between the CIA and the Iranians on London's streets. What she didn't need to do was to create a violent incident in the backyard of America's strongest ally.
"Quietly," she said finally. "No one does anything but watch unless I give the order. And call Charlie. We need to bring MI6 in on this." Kennedy hung up and dialed Mitch Rapp's cell number. Until now, she'd left him alone. He rarely disappeared like this, so it stood to reason that what he was doing was important to him. She couldn't wait any longer, though. Wherever he was, his vacation was over. Her stomach tightened with each ring, but finally the line clicked and Rapp's voice came on.
"Yeah."
"Where are you?"
"Greece."
"Get to London, now."